Last year, I think it was last year, we attended the National Criminal Justice Association conference, and Ernie gave a presentation which, as people walked out of the room, felt that it was a very, very powerful discussion. He specifically talked a lot about information sharing and the importance of information sharing, and we thought it was an appropriate message for Global for Ernie to come and talk to about his perspectives on the importance of information sharing and how Global can or has played a role. So with that, Ernie, yes, thank you.
No, I'm honored to be here for a number of reasons, but most of which, I've always been convinced that we share the same set of goals and beliefs. I've said to millions of people, maybe not millions of people, I've said to a lot of people that the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children finds missing children, helps attack the problem of child sexual exploitation, rescues the victims, works with law enforcement to identify the perpetrators, primarily through the use of images and information. So I think in many ways we're almost a beta site for demonstrating the power of information. For example, we use and promote the XML model. Most of you are aware that among other things that we do with and for the Justice Department, we are the disseminators of secondary Amber Alerts through the wireless community, for example. So the wireless carriers are transmitting Amber Alert messages and information via text message. And the mechanism through which we disseminate the Amber information to the wireless community is XML. So that's what we do. And so what I would like to do briefly today is talk to you about the power and importance of information in protecting America's children, to give you a little bit of history and background on what we're doing, and then give you some specific illustrations about why I think this is such an important issue. Most of you around the table are old enough to remember the catalyst for the creation of the National Center, and that was the abduction and murder of six-year-old Adam Walsh in Hollywood, Florida in 1981. The most high-profile child abduction case since the Lindbergh kidnapping. On every newspaper front page, in every television broadcast. As you know, ultimately, 2 weeks later, Adam's severed head was found in a drainage ditch 100 miles north of that shopping mall in Hollywood, Florida. But during the time of the search, the Walsh family took the posters that they created of their child, contacted every police department in their home state of Florida, just to make sure that if a police officer in Orlando made a traffic stop and there was a little boy in the back seat that looked like Adam, he would at least ask some questions, at least detain the guy. What the Walshes discovered was that 80% of the police departments in their home state, in the wake of the most high-profile child abduction case in American history, had no idea who Adam Walsh was, had no idea that their little boy was missing. What the Walshes learned was that if the abductor had the sense enough to take the child across the county line, or God forbid the state line, you were on your own. This was a nation of 50 states that acted like 50 separate countries and 18,000 different police departments that by and large didn't talk to each other. So in 1984, John Walsh and I and some others launched the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And we did it with one basic idea in mind, and that was to create a national response to the problem of missing and exploited children, a coordinated national response. So today, there are state clearinghouses in every state, and there's rapid dissemination of information. And today, more missing children come home safely than at any time in the nation's history. Our own work at the National Center, focusing on the most serious cases where the children are at greatest risk. In 1990, we were proud of the fact that the recovery rate was 62%. Today, it's 97%. And that is a direct result of the power of technology and information. Working in partnership with the U.S. Department of Justice, the center operates the National Missing Children's Hotlines, handled 2.5 million calls for service. We've received 685,000 reports of child sexual exploitation through our cyber tip line, the 911 for the internet. We've reviewed 22 million child pornography images and videos in an effort to identify and rescue the children who are being used and abused. We resolved 400 long-term cases through the work of our cold case unit, including one from 1947. We've located 900 long-term missing children through the use of imaging technology. Age progressions of long-term missing children have identified dozens of unidentified deceased children as a result of facial reconstructions from skeletal remains or morgue photos. We're tracking attempted abductions of children through our analysis unit, trying to link those cases between jurisdictions. Because, again, even today, if there's a blue van that tries to grab a kid in Columbus, Ohio, and a blue van tries to grab a kid in Indianapolis, the greatest likelihood, even today, is that they're going to be viewed as separate, isolated acts and not part of a pattern of behavior of an offender traveling from state to state. We're tracking down hundreds of non-compliant or missing sex offenders in support of the U.S. Marshals Service and state law enforcement, largely through the use of donated public record databases, simply because in so many of these cases, state and local law enforcement doesn't have the resources or the ability to do that themselves. Time is the enemy in the search for a missing child. And we're a 24-hour organization. As you may recall, 25 years ago, most American police departments had mandatory waiting periods. If your child disappeared, local law enforcement would say, well, if he doesn't show up, he's probably just run away. If he doesn't show up in 24, 48, 72 hours, call us back. We'll take a report and investigate. That's a problem. It's a problem because we now know in the most serious cases in abduction homicides, in three-fourths of those cases, the child is dead within the first 3 hours. So you can't wait until tomorrow. You have to move now. So our center is a 24-hour operation, and since the 1990s, when a child is reported missing and local law enforcement thinks that the child's at great risk, there's this so-called CA flag, a box on that reporting form that Harlan and I worked on a decade ago. That report prints out in our center instantly so that we get a running start on these cases. Today we're working with the 911 community. We've worked with the leading associations, NINA and APCO and NAED, to develop standardized protocols for 911 centers because the quality and the consistency of the information that's captured at that first report is often key to the likelihood of success. There's been great progress. We've come light years in the past quarter century, yet I still can't get out of my mind that terrible case in 1993 involving the abduction and murder of 12-year-old Polly Klass of Petaluma, California. Many of you probably remember two Sonoma County deputies stopped Richard Allen Davis, the abductor and killer of the child, at a time when reportedly the child was still alive and restrained in a nearby area. Those two deputies knew there was something wrong with this guy. They questioned him for 40 minutes. But they had no reason, no basis for detaining him or arresting him. Why? Because Sonoma County was on a different radio frequency than the county from which the child had been abducted, and they didn't know there had been a recent child abduction. And secondly, Richard Allen Davis had just been released from prison, so even though they queried NCIC, there were no wants or warrants. He was a really dangerous guy with a lot of history, but they didn't know it. They did everything right, but the child still died. There are lots of other examples. Well, what can we do about it? I know your time is limited, and I promise not to drone on and on, as is my penchant. But let me try to provide four specific examples of why I believe that greater connectivity and more information sharing are so important. One, I believe that improved information sharing is vital to our ability to address the growing complexity and interconnectedness of criminal activity. A couple of examples. One is child pornography. Recently, the FBI, found direct connections between operators of child pornography sites and a host of other criminal enterprises, like phishing, illegal pharma sales, and malware. In fact, they found that 20% of child pornography sites attempt to install malware. So you can't look at these things in isolation. Another example is our battle against human trafficking. When people think about trafficking in children, you think about Southeast Asia, Central America. What they don't recognize is it's a major problem on Main Street USA. 5 years ago, our center joined with the FBI and the Justice Department's Child Exploitation and Obscenity Section in a new effort called Innocence Lost, targeting the sexual trafficking of children in the United States. Our premises were simple. One, this is organized crime. Not mafia, not La Cosa Nostra, but organized nonetheless. These kids are commodities for sale or trade. There is a network. They are trafficked. They are moved from city to city for the financial gain of those who use, abuse, and control them. And historically, the response to this problem has been a narrow local response. When law enforcement sees it, they arrest the kid. Somebody pays the fine, the operators move the kid to another city, where it becomes another city's problem. Second premise, that the kids are victims, not perpetrators. This is 21st century slavery. These kids lack the ability to walk away. The pimps who brutalize them are the criminals, as are those who patronize them. These kids need to be rescued, not arrested. And thirdly, that technology has changed the playing field. What pimps and operators used to do is parade these kids on the streets of America's cities. Now they market and sell them via the internet, via Craigslist and similar services. You can shop for a kid for sex from the privacy of your own home or hotel room with virtually no risk. So our goal was to connect the dots, to bring together agencies, share information, and attack these criminals who historically have been able to operate with virtual anonymity and almost no risk. The FBI has created 34 multi-jurisdictional, multidisciplinary task forces across the country. The National Center is the central information hub in this operation, taking reports from the public and from internet service providers and others. We're also training the participants in these task forces. The results? Local, state, and federal agencies working together and sharing information have generated 800 arrests, 400 convictions, some in the federal system, some in the state system. Three of these offenders have received life sentences. Many of these offenders are receiving 20 years and up, which is absolutely unprecedented in addressing these kinds of crimes. Historically, they pay fines. Today, these traffickers are going away for long periods of time. And most importantly, 685 kids have been rescued and are getting help. The power of information sharing. Second example I want to give you is that information sharing can help us identify victims. In 2002, example I want to cite, 2002, the Supreme Court of the United States held in what we believe is a misguided, inaccurate opinion, but Supreme Court of the United States delivered it nonetheless, that virtual child pornography is protected speech. An actual child has to be harmed in order for child pornography to be unlawful and not protected under the First Amendment. There's been a very predictable result. When defendants are arrested these days and computers are seized and there are thousands of images on the computers, defense counsel are arguing, these aren't real kids. And judges, not all judges, but some judges across the country are saying to prosecutors, prove to us that these are real kids. And so in 2002, following that decision, we created a child victim identification program at the center to try to do the work for the prosecutors in identifying for them the real kids in that mix. There are 5,000 images, and we can identify five of them. That's enough to sustain the conviction. Our analysts are using every possible tool to place these kids somewhere on planet Earth. so that we can then work with the local law enforcement agency, or state, or federal, or international, to do the follow-up. When law enforcement identifies a child, it goes into our database. And we now have become the central hub for identifying children in these prosecutions for the world. So we're getting identifications from law enforcement all over the world. Since 2003, our analysts have reviewed 22 million child pornography images and videos, 8.6 million last year alone. We're currently reviewing 200,000 images a week because this is an exploding problem. We've provided 15,000 evidence reports to prosecutors in the United States alone, 4,500 last year. Well, what have we learned? We've learned that the victims aren't and don't look at all like society thinks they look. The vast majority of the victims are prepubescent, and the images are getting more violent, more graphic. Of the offenders who've been identified as a result of this effort, 39% have had images of children younger than 6 years old. 19% have had images of children younger than 3 years old. We have learned that of the perpetrators who are victimizing the children and taking these photographs, 27% of them were parents. Another 10% are other family members. 25% are neighbors or people close to the child. So again, the myth of the stranger, the person who is preying upon kids and taking these images, is someone who has easy and legitimate access to the child. And we also learn that in this era of digital technology, there's a growing number of these images which are self-produced, largely as a result of online enticement by someone who persuades a child to take a photo of themselves with a cell phone or a webcam or other technology. There's currently a raging debate over the issue of sexting. You know, how serious is it? When should it result in criminal charges as opposed to simple education? We've launched a campaign with the Ad Council called Think Before You Post. We're at a time in our culture, in our society, when we have all this technology in the hands of kids whose brains haven't developed enough to the point where they can recognize and understand the implications and repercussions of what they're doing. So the bottom line, in terms of this point in information sharing, is absent real information sharing in this complex age, not just nationally but globally, these victims and their perpetrators go unidentified. Third point, while technology is a huge part of the problem, it is also a significant part of the solution. We are trying to attack sexual exploitation of children by partnering with key leaders of industry. For example, we have a technology coalition that includes eight major companies, eight of the leading internet companies, who are helping us develop and deploy technology to identify specific illegal images in order to disrupt the transmission of those images online. For example, we know that 95% of the images of child pornography that are out there are going to stay out there forever. Every one of those images has a digital fingerprint or hash value. So companies like Microsoft and Yahoo and Google and AOL and others are helping us build a database of hash values so that as these images are transmitted, they can be identified and interdicted. In developing this system, clearly there are some interesting technological challenges, not the least of which is that every one of these companies is using different compression technologies. And again, we're using the XML standard to try to develop a mechanism so that the image that we receive and verify and that we transmit this hash is read in the same way by everybody's system. But this is technology that obviously has implications far beyond child pornography in addressing a host of illegal activities involving internet transmission. We're also working with the ISPs on an initiative to limit access to specific websites containing apparent child pornography. Our cyber tip line analysts identify these sites, these web pages, and do daily screen captures. And our focus for this purpose is the worst of the worst, We're trying to be very sensitive to legitimate First Amendment and privacy concerns. So we're limiting the web pages captured to those that contain images of prepubescent children where there is actual physical penetration of the child. So images that nobody can contend are protected by the First Amendment. Currently, 62 major ISPs have signed an MOU with the center, and we are providing a list of those web pages on a daily basis. We do daily screen captures so that if an image disappears, the site comes off the list. And this is purely voluntary. There's no government mandate. Our premise is ISPs remove content from their systems every day that violate their terms of use policy. And the other premise of all of this is for all that law enforcement is doing, we will never be able to arrest and prosecute everybody. So the goal of these two initiatives is to try to attack the demand side, to keep these images from reaching the consumers in their basements at home in their privacy or trying to access this kind of content. Let me cite one other quick real-world example of, I think, the power of technology and information sharing. Our analysts worked a case not long ago in which we saw a photo of a little blonde-haired girl who appeared to be 8 or 9 years old being sexually assaulted on a very distinctive bedspread. About a week later, one of our analysts saw a little brunette girl being abused on the same, what looked to be the same distinctive bedspread. So one of the things that we did was we went to the internet, tried to determine who the manufacturer of the bedspread was, find out how they were marketed and sold, where they were marketed and sold, and try to track down the sale of that bedspread to the person who bought it. Wasn't terribly successful, but through using other data sets and other search tools, we ultimately identified the first little girl. And through her, we identified the second little girl. Both children were being victimized by a friend of the father of one of the children. So we identified the perpetrator, rescued the two kids. The offender was just sentenced to the first ever life sentence for these kinds of crimes in the history of the state of Indiana. So it's a good news story. Our friends at Google, I was telling that story. I made a presentation to a Google employee group. And they said, you mean to tell me that you were able to identify these children and the perpetrator based on the memory of one of your young analysts who's looking at 200,000 images a week? And I said, well, yeah. He said, we can help. He said, nobody better at search technology than we are. And so a group of Google engineers have developed a tool that they're calling a bedspread detector. And the premise is when one of our analysts sees an element of an image, distinctive element of the image, whether a bedspread or a logo on a T-shirt or a potted plant or a framed picture on the wall, we now have the capability to search our whole database of images looking for every time that common image appears. So it should give us the ability to identify many more victims and link many more cases. Those are the kinds of information tools that I think represent the future of this effort. And now my fourth and final point. Government can't do it alone. We need to build strong, viable public-private partnerships. Now, we at the center have been trying to do that for 25 years. I think most of you know, to millions of Americans, we're the milk carton people. But we're currently distributing missing child photos through a network of 400 private sector partners, bulletin boards in every Walmart store. The little Have You Seen Me flyers from Advo that go into 85 million homes a week, all at no cost to taxpayers. We're tracking down abductors and non-compliant sex offenders through the use of donated public record databases from LexisNexis and ChoicePoint and a host of other companies. One of the most compelling examples, the last example I promise I'll give you, of the power of public-private partnerships emanates from one out of those 685,000 reports that we've handled through the cyber tip line. We received a report a number of years ago regarding a husband and wife pair of entrepreneurs in Texas who weren't making enough money doing what they were doing, so they went into the child pornography business. And we followed up Dallas Police, FBI, Postal Inspection Service. When the people were arrested and their business was shut down, they had 70,000 customers paying $29.95 a month and using their credit cards to access graphic images of 4-, 5-, and 6-year-olds being raped and sexually assaulted. I can remember my reaction as if it were yesterday. How is that possible? And what the credit card companies told us is, we don't know what these transactions are for. You know, they're not using the business code for child pornography. You know, they're not writing that on the voucher. But they said, if you can identify for us in a timely way where the merchant bank is, where the account resides, this is an illegal use of the payment system, we can stop the payments and shut it down. So what we did was bring together 31 companies, MasterCard, Visa, American Express, Bank of America, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, Chase, international companies, Banco Bradesco in Brazil, Deutsche Bank, HSBC, some of the major internet companies, and we developed a process through which every time we identify a site with method of payment on it, we verify the existence of the site. The companies give us live accounts. We use federal, state, and local law enforcement to provide those accounts so they attempt to make purchases. When they identify, when the purchase goes through, you identify where the account is, where the bank is. We then give that information to law enforcement first. So law enforcement has 10 days in which to initiate an investigation or action. If they don't, I then alert the payment company, which is stopping the payments, shutting down the accounts, trying to put these people out of business. Now, obviously, they move around. But in 3 years, here's what's happened. The price point of this industry has gone from $29.95 a month to $700 or $800, $1,000 a month. Secondly, the use of the credit card has been virtually eliminated. You still see credit card logos, but when you click on that logo and provide your information, what typically happens is nothing. They're stealing your identity. And if you stop to think about it, it's sort of the perfect crime, because who are you going to tell? When they do come back to you, they come back to you and provide you another method of payment, and they're developing more customized method of payments. But we're attacking those as well. So, you know, what I submit is that this sort of public-private model, law enforcement first, but using existing law and techniques to go after it in another way, is something we need to consider. So let me conclude. I submit that today more than ever, the solutions for these complex challenges require the exchange of data and information. 21st century criminal enterprises are more organized than ever before and are using new technologies to evade detection. We have to be just as committed to developing and utilizing new technologies against them, and we have to work together, overcoming the barriers of format, turf, discipline, and jurisdiction, sharing information with each other, and recognizing that increasingly those who engage in criminal activity are working together, so must we. I'm delighted to have been with you. I'm sure I've abused the time, but if there is any, I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you, Patrick. You had a comment, Patrick.
Well, I just want to thank Ernie, and I want to give Cabell, the reason why this we invited Ernie at last year's NCJA forum, Ernie spoke, and being a retired police officer, even I was so impressed. And so, you know, it just takes the air out of your lungs to hear Ernie speak and the issues facing. But what was great was, in this hall of 1,000 people, somebody way back at the Q&A period said, Ernie, what's the biggest challenge you're facing? You know, and his response, without a beat, was information sharing and collaboration. And I thought, what better message that we could hear today from Ernie, even though we didn't give him a lot of time. I just want to thank you and credit all the great work that NCMEC's doing. We're really glad to have you here today.
Thank you, Pat.
Harlan. I have to say, Ernie, in front of all these people, you're one of my heroes, and I think everybody in this room realizes you're an American hero because you have championed this cause in a way that nobody else could do, and we really appreciate that.
Thank you, Harlan.
Yeah, thank you, Ernie. And, you know, when you listen to you hear a lot of depressing stuff when you talk, but you all also hear a lot of positive things about the things that are being done to stop it and the numbers, that one number that jumped out about the 97% rather than 30% or whatever it was is really compelling. So thank you very much.
No, thank all of you for what you're doing.
Very good. Thank you, Ernie. We appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.